Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rink, Jack Spencer, and our special guests this week, Adrian Hemond and Brian Beacon from Grassroots Midwest. Thanks again for joining us, guys. You're one of our favorite guests. I guess that's why we keep inviting you over here.
Always a pleasure.
Oh, I'm always glad to be here. I always got an opinion.
All right. Well, we wanted to get going now that the legislature's all set. We want to go and dive into the primaries, and nobody covers the state legislative races like us, and nobody works these races like you guys. So together, maybe we'll come up with some ideas on what's actually going on out there. At least that's the hope. To set the stage here, why don't we start with kind of the big view and then zero in on what's going on the ground. Donald Trump, that's still the big story, isn't it, guys?
Absolutely. He's the president. He is very adroit at making news, whether on politics, policy, or other random things, and as long as Donald Trump's the president, we're going to be talking about him. That is his shtick. That's what he does, and he's very good at it.
How is Donald Trump influencing these primaries, Brian?
Well, a lot of it is just that he's kind of setting the message for the Republican Party right now, because he is the Republican Party, whether people like that or not. But, you know, he's setting an agenda. He's following through on a lot of things that he said. He's getting good hits, so you just want to be attached to him, because you see folks like Mark Sanford, who was very like, I hate Trump or never Trump. Well, he lost his primary. So I think you're going to see that, and especially you're seeing that in the gubernatorial primary right now, is that Trump is the standard bearer, and Republicans largely, in a lot of the polls I've seen, where he's like at 85-90% amongst Republicans.
Even in his worst districts, state legislative districts, congressional districts, in the polling that we've seen, his worst districts with Republican primary voters, he's at about 70%.
Wow, 70%. So that means if you are an incumbent right now, like it or not, you got to cozy up to Trump.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to necessarily endorse every single thing that he does, but you got to find some stuff to hang your hat on about how you agree with the president and you're helping to implement his agenda on at least some subset of issues that he's using to connect with his base, because his base is the base of the Republican Party. And if you want to win a Republican primary, you've got to be there.
Does that work transversely then with Democrats? If you want to win your Democratic primary, do you have to be anti-Trump?
I think there's an element of truth to that. I think that there are some districts that are exceptional in that regard, especially as you look at some of the relatively few northern Michigan districts that are held by Democrats in the Upper Peninsula, where even with Democrats, you know, sort of blue-collar Democrats, Trump's reasonably popular. It can't just be Trump hate, but yeah, and I mean, in most seats that Democrats hold right now or have much hope of holding with the Dem primary electorate, you'd better be anti-Trump.
But there are some issues, again, like going into some more your blue-collar districts too, where again the tariffs thing is something that you can kind of go on, because Gretchen Driscoll even like was like, yep, the tariffs are all right, protect American steel jobs, because you're trying to get these like blue collar folks who are slow and other like skilled trade folks who are slowly shifting more Republican, because the Republicans seem to be there a bit more on their issues, because, you know, with Trump talking about their jobs specifically and not running up against the, you know, environmental aspect of it. You know, you got guys that hunt, own guns, you know, a little bit more socially conservative, who are shifting away from the Democratic Party. So in some of these marginal races, they have to take a few Trump issues. But again, in a lot of your metro area ones, yeah, Trump's bad, but a lot of them already hate Trump. So there's really no pivoting there or positioning.
And we're seeing some candidates like Scott DeAnda, who's actually not running away from Trump. He seems to be a lot like Trump.
Yeah, I mean, and that's smart politics for Scott. The president's reasonably popular in the Upper Peninsula, in northern lower Michigan. You know, Scott seems to be in a reasonably comfortable place with his primary as well. You know, for the general electorate up there, if he wants to win a state Senate seat made up of the entire Upper Peninsula and a large portion of the northern lower, again, you better have something to hang your hat on. You don't have to agree with everything the president does, but the president's, you know, reasonably popular with those folks, and you better reckon with that.
Brian, where is the enthusiasm right now? Where is the voter enthusiasm as we head into the primary? Who's going to be voting?
That's the funny thing with primaries, too. It's usually the true believers, because you're looking at about 20% of the electorate as a whole. And depending on the district, you might get, you know, 50% of that's Republican, 50% is Dem. So it's a very small group. It's the true believers. Again, the hardcore Trump people, too, or the hardcore anti-Trump. These are the people that pick it. And that's why in some of these like safe seats, you get more of the extremes than sort of, you know, the more moderate types.
Let's kind of zero in on some of the primaries. And Adrian, you got your spreadsheet out, which gets me very excited. Tell me a little bit about, we'll start in the Senate. What primaries are you keeping an eye on? And for our listeners' benefit, make sure to disclose which ones you're working.
Yeah, of course. Primaries that I find particularly interesting right now, down in the city of Detroit, you've got a really crowded primary in Senate District 2. Former State Representative Brian Banks is having another go. My former boss, George Cushenberry, the last Democrat to chair the House Appropriations Committee, is also having a go at that. More familiar names like Adam Hollier, Lamar Lemons, John Alumba, and a number of other folks have filed for this as well. So that one's going to be exciting, in a certain sense unusual for a state Senate primary, in that, you know, you might win that primary with 1,000 votes, with as many candidates are in there. You chop the electorate up enough with enough named candidates there, and you might be able to get out of that with 1,000 or 1,200 votes. So that one's certainly very interesting. Senate District 34 is interesting in that you've got contested primaries on both sides, where I think the state parties have preferences in who those candidates would be. The caucuses have preferences in who those candidates would be. You know, John Bumstead and Holly Hughes is a competitive primary. Obviously, Holly Hughes has got him severely outgunned in terms of financial resources, but Bumstead's out there working it, knocking doors all over the district. On the Dem side, you have Poppy Cias Hernandez, who's been in the race for about 9 months, and Colleen Lamonte, who got in pre-filing deadline. There's been some sore feelings with Democrats in Muskegon because of the amount of work that Poppy has put into that primary already. You know, Colleen's a great name candidate for a general election, but there's some heartburn with some Democrats about the field being almost cleared for Colleen when she got into the race late. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops. One primary that we are in that we'll disclose, the Republican primary for the 24th State Senate District, currently occupied by Rick Jones. You've got a real knockdown dragout between Brett Roberts and Tom Barrett. You've seen more of the spending from Team Roberts there, which is the side that we're on. But Tom Barrett's obviously a very attractive candidate who's had, in one of those counties, a couple million dollars spent on him in general elections over the last 4 years. So it'll be real interesting to see how that comes out. Another one that we're involved in is the Senate primary to replace Mike Knopfs. That's in the 19th Senate District. John Bison, current representative, who's a former client of ours, and Mike Calton, former representative, who's a client of ours now, are facing off. That's a pretty safe Republican district at plus six. Very interesting to see how that one comes out. Bison's got more personal money. Calton's got more money raised and has been doing a lot more communication with voters to date. But that'll be another very interesting one to follow there. Scrolling down a little bit in our spreadsheet you made reference to. Senate District 26, another safe Republican seat. You've got former Representative and Lottery Commissioner Eric Nesbitt facing off against Bob Janetsky. We're not involved in that primary, but I have seen some polling there that indicates that the former Representative Janetsky is in a pretty strong position because of his name ID from being the clerk in Allegan County. You know, Representative Nesbitt is obviously a very good fundraiser and has got a lot of friends in the interest group community, but he's got some catching up to do.
Well, and that one's a tough one, too, for Nesbitt, because he got in a little later, I think, than Janetsky did on that one. And Janetsky has represented countywide, whereas Nesbitt's coming in from the outside, Brian.
Nesbitt is really popular in Van Buren, which is a very small portion of the area. And again, for the time he was out of the legislature for the last 2 years, he was doing lottery commissioner and other things, and he wasn't really necessarily working the circuit, whereas like the last 4 years or so, and even since leaving the legislature, Bob Janetsky's been out there doing things. You know, he's present, and again, Allegan County is where a good chunk of the vote comes out of. So, yeah, he's out been doing the work, and people are familiar with him, they know him, and, you know, clearly they like him. That's why they keep putting him in office.
Now, I've heard he's a carpetbagger.
I mean, sure. And look, that attack gets used all the time in all sorts of campaigns. To be frank, we use that attack fairly frequently in campaigns, especially when there's not much else to use. I'm skeptical of the effectiveness of that sort of attack.
I don't think it's ever really worked. You know, I don't know how many times we've tried it and how many times we've had so much proof. But yeah, it's never really worked out because it's not something that people really get too worked up about.
Now, you mentioned a little earlier the Tom Barrett, Brett Roberts seat, and I also wanted to tie into that the Kevin Daley, Gary Glenn seat, because we have some outside money being spent in both of those districts, presumably by Consumers Energy against Gary Glenn and against Tom Barrett for their vote against the electric choice package that was passed a couple years ago. How effective do you think that money is going to be in impacting that race and influencing that race, you know, those two races?
Just in general, that sort of spending is the wave of the future, whether it's through an independent PAC, a super PAC, whether it's through a 501c4 organization, whether it's from business or from labor. These institutions can raise more money than candidates, and they tend to be more effective at spending it. A lot of institutions have also figured out that if you cut a check to a candidate, you have no idea what they're going to do with that money. If you go out and do real things for them that you know are effective tactics, you know that that can move the needle, especially if you've done good polling. And so I think even just this election cycle, I think you just should expect to see more of that, you know, whether it's from, you know, regulated industries or it's from organized labor on the Dem side or even in some Republican primaries. It's the wave of the future right now. The institutions are just so much more effective than individual candidates.
Yeah. That's the thing. It doesn't take a lot of money to win a primary, because especially when you start acting from the state house, if you raise $15,000, yeah, but do you know how to spend it? But if someone comes in and drops $40,000 for you, takes out your opponents and boosts your name, that's what you need. And again, going back to like who turns out, you know, this is kind of how you can try and get more reasonable legislators on how you define reasonable, you know, not the necessary like true believer hardcores that are going to vote no on everything, that hate anything that's business or anything that's like regulated. Yes. Not saying they're trying to buy the legislature, but they're just trying to have people they can work with, because in term limits, as you're just churning them out, you need people you work with, because 6 years is a short time to realize how the world works. You know, you're still going to be like, no, this is evil, this is wrong. I think that's why they're getting involved at this early stage now, as opposed to trying to get in late.
Has Barrett done anything to counter that? Because I've seen those advertisements everywhere on Roberts taking that vote.
But correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, but I believe that the Barrett campaign's only sent one mail piece so far.
Yeah, it looked like it was their door-to-door piece. They sent that out maybe 2 weeks ago, and that's the only mail that I've heard of, because obviously I have family in Shiawassee County, and I got a lot of friends in Delta, and I live in Clinton. And that's all I've seen, so in terms of mail-wise, whereas knowing what the Roberts mail plan is, yeah, there's a lot of mail that's gone out, and again, a lot of TV and radio that's been put out there by other sources. So, and again, but I think the Barrett folks are more focused on Kelly Rossman, really, than Brett Roberts. I think they view Brett as sort of not a real threat, so... Again, I've heard that they've even run anti-robocalls against Kelly Rossman at this point.
Right. Kelly Rossman being the Democratic front runner. Well, she doesn't have a primary, so she's going to be the nominee there in the 24th district.
Yeah, that's right. I think this outside spending, like I said, part of the reason this is the wave of the future is changes in the regulatory structure, whether that's been based on court decisions or it's been based on legislation that's been passed. But part of it is the polarization that's going on in the electorate and with elected lawmakers is concerning for institutions, whether you're a labor union or you're a regulated industry or you're a trade association. These folks have started to figure out that the outcomes that are happening in primaries are bad. And so if you're an institutional investor and you know that there's going to be extreme partisanship in the legislature, it's probably a good investment for you to get involved in primaries. If you can get somebody through a primary, Democrat or Republican, who will vote with you 30% of the time in a safe district of that party, that's probably a good investment.
I want to ask a little bit about the 24th, because as I talk to our subscribers, the question I get so often is does Kelly Rossman and McKinney really have a decent shot at this district? And what I always point out is it's a pretty conservative district. I wonder if you could sort of talk about, from a numbers perspective, what do you think her chances really are?
I think that her winning chances depend on a couple of things. Number one is what turnout looks like this year and whether there is, in fact, a blue wave. I'm pretty skeptical of that at this point, but she'll need some help in that regard. I'd put her on about one chance in three overall, but some of that depends on who the Republican nominee is. I think she's got a much better chance against Tom Barrett, who's a lot more ideological than Brett Roberts. I think Brett is a little bit more reflective of what people in the district are actually like. The thing that I find to be kind of a drawback for Kelly right now, and I mean, Kelly's a messaging professional, so I don't doubt she has a strategy to overcome this, is how socially conservative that district is. Labor density is actually quite high in that district, especially in Eaton County. Even the parts of Shiawassee County that are this side of I-69, those are bedroom communities for Lansing right now. Their employees are UAW Local 6000. They work at a school district. The laborers have their training facility in Perry. You know, there are a lot of unionized folks there. There are also a lot of Eastern European Catholics in Shiawassee County. The white side of my family, you know, was raised in Owosso and went to, you know, an Eastern European Catholic church in Owosso. And yeah, they like their labor union, but they don't don't like abortions, they're pretty conservative about gay rights, and they like their guns. That problem's even more intense in Clinton County. And look, the Democratic candidate's not going to win Clinton County. They can win in Bath, they can win in DeWitt, but they're not going to win with what I call the K-13s, the Koenigsconnect, the German Catholics in northern Clinton County. They're going to get blown out there for a lot of the same reasons that they traditionally lose in Shiawassee. Shiawassee's close to 50-50 in terms of the partisan breakdown there, but it's a different sort of Democrat. They're more socially conservative. Eaton County, obviously, she's got Delta Township. She'll perform very well there in the general election. Once you get outside of Delta Township, Grand Ledge, Oneida Township, it starts to look a lot like Shiawassee and Clinton counties after that.
The biggest thing she has going for her is that she doesn't have to spend money, and I think the last campaign finance filing, she's around $300. So, you know, when we see the next filing, she could be at like $400 or so. Because she's going to have the money on her side, plus whatever money, you know, she's going to get spent. And again, with Barrett or Roberts, they're going to have to play catch-up a lot in terms of the money game. And again, depending on how the rest of this primary goes, they're going to have some bruises, you know, some attacks that can be followed up on and beat up on. So the fact that she has a clear shot, and as far as I can tell, she's been doing some work, so she has a puncher's chance, but I think, you know, the numbers-wise and just knowing the demographics, having pretty much lived throughout the district, is favorable to a Republican.
Doesn't sound like you put any money on it.
It depends on what sort of odds you're giving me, but, like, if I'm straight up, then no, I'm not putting any money on that.
In these primaries where we have situations where we have current reps going against former reps, and we've got quite a few of them, whether you're talking about Joe Hoppin going up against Daniela Garcia and Roger Victory, or Bruce Rendon and Ray Franz going up against Kurt Vanderwall, or we already mentioned Gary Glenn and Kevin Daley. How much of an advantage does the incumbent have, having already been in office, as opposed to somebody who hasn't been in office for a couple years, Brian?
Well, some of it's out of sight, out of mind, because a lot of these people, once they leave office, they're not really preparing for the next step. So people aren't really familiar with them. And again, depending on with the legislator, is that they're still out doing all the community events. They're going to things, plus they're doing their own state mailing, and in some cases, like, you know, their constituent contact. So they have 2 years, they have the platform that they're going out and being able to make some connection with voters, where, again, where some of these guys have been sitting on the sidelines for a few years, and again, a large portion of the populace really isn't in tune to, like, their legislator to begin with. So if they're not hearing or seeing the name for, like, 2 to 4 years, that's kind of sliding, and they're only thinking about the current sort of what they're seeing.
So you would say that the person who's currently in office does have an advantage?
Well, yes, and also on the fundraising, because a lot of the PACs are a little bit skeptical of primaries. But if you're a current legislator and you're having like a fundraiser for your House CT or so, they're going to be more amenable to it because you're still affecting things. Right. So there's going to be a fundraising advantage, too.
Even if an institutional investor won't give you money as a sitting lawmaker running against someone who's been out of office, they're far less likely to give money to your opponent because you're still there pressing the red and green button. And so unless that relationship has gone so far south that they can never hope to get a vote from you on anything, then why would you invest? That person's going to be there and be able to affect the outcomes that you care about as opposed to this person that's out of office. That's yet another reason you're starting to see more of this outside spending that can't be explicitly traced to people, some more than others, but whether it's donating to a soft money account that's maintained by a lawmaker or it's doing independent spending that can't be traced back to your institution, that gives you the ability to impact the outcome without antagonizing somebody who goes in and sits on the House floor 3 days a week.
And then I also wanted to ask you, Adrian, about very competitive, very interesting Democratic primary. I think kind of is a microcosm of what we're seeing in the Democratic Party right now. Erica Geis versus Bob Kosowski, kind of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party versus the old blue dog kind of conservative wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and full disclosure, we're involved in this one. Representative Kosowski is both a client and a good friend of mine. I don't 100% agree with that characterization in the sense that Bob Kosowski is a true blue labor Democrat, and I think that that's going to be one of the things that's going to help him a lot here. But you're right in the sense that Erica is a base candidate, and she is speaking to the sort of furthest left aspects of the Democratic Party, which the success of a strategy like that really depends on what the primary electorate looks like. If you look at the folks that are in this district that are voting in Taylor, in Westland, in Brownstown Township, places like that, these are not ultra-liberal Dem primary voters. Certainly, there's a contingent of that. There's always a contingent of the furthest extreme in any sort of primary electorate. But this doesn't look like a primary electorate in Ann Arbor or in East Lansing. These are blue-collar folks that, you know, work in auto factories, in what remaining steel plants there are down there. They work in the power plants. They work in a skilled trades. And they tend to be a little bit more on the conservative side for Democrats.
Yep, Trump Democrats. Yeah, because, again, Trump, you know, performed over, he didn't win the area, but he performed a bit over a lot of Republicans typically do, because again, you get to that downriver parts of Westland where you got a lot of these blue collar folks who are more affected by those sort of issues. And, you know, Trump is speaking to them because again, that was the thing. Hillary took that labor vote for granted. Again, you got a lot of Trump Democrats in that area, however many. So it's not Ann Arbor. It's not like any of those other really, or even the city of Detroit. You got to kind of play a fine line.
On that topic, though, with those Trump Democrats, Trump's not on the ballot this time. So I'm curious, is there a potential problem keeping those people voting for Republicans after they see something like the prevailing wage vote at the Capitol? Is that the kind of situation where something like that happening in a year like this, actually just before the summer break, Republicans might end up actually losing some of those people?
I think there's certainly a potential for that, you know, in some of these areas. I think it's real dependent on geography and sort of demography. But I do think that, you know, without Trump carrying that message, that there will be some bleed there. And I think it's pretty unlikely that the president's going to show up to stump for state legislative candidates. If you don't have him out there using the bully pulpit, which there hasn't been anyone better at that in American politics in quite a while, then yeah, you're going to lose some votes. How much bleed there is an open question, and I think could be determinative in some of these seats.
You know, more likely to get his hands dirty than any other former president, because he's pretty much still running a campaign, and I can guarantee that he's going to do rallies in Michigan for Bill Schuette, who will likely win the Republican primary, and he's going to try and gin up the vote for all these other candidates, like whoever the Senate candidate is and a lot of these House candidates go on, because yes, you're correct. Without Trump on the ballot, you know, there could be like a correction, you know, in some of these districts where we saw these unexpected victories like Joe Bellino, you know, that was really carried by a lot of these Trump Democrats. You know, that's something to look out for. But again, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if the state Republican Party and the partisan caucuses overplay their hand a little bit. There were some places where Trump overperformed Republicans very well, where Republicans' typical numbers very well, where there might be a temptation to go play in seats where actually you don't belong. And that's some place that a correction like that could hurt them very bad. Representative Pam Ferris is term limited, right? Trump edged that district out, just barely. That's the hardest sort of labor country, suburban Genesee County. And to your point, you know, the prevailing wage vote, that's going to hurt the Republican brand there some. The Republicans in the House and in the Senate have got a majority, and they really need to focus on protecting those seats that they have and not let their eyes get too big for their stomach, get caught chasing some of these places where the Trump effect last time might lead them to believe that they can compete, when really in a midterm presidential year, they cannot.
Even with the prevailing wage too, because again, you have a lot of the skilled trade folks that do lean Republican, because, you know, you have like some of your AFSCME's, SEIU's that are, you know, true blue Democrats. But again, a lot of these building trade fit the Republican model. Yeah, leadership is hardcore Dem, but, you know, these are people that typically will vote Republican. And again, I think, you know, they could feel a little burned on the whole prevailing wage thing. So especially when you get north of Clare, the areas that are really becoming the Republican stronghold, that could hurt you statewide.
Let's change the subject here a little bit. Going to the House now, which House incumbent do you guys feel is most in trouble going into the primary?
My top selection there has got to be Representative Jewell Jones down in, I believe it's the 11th, out of Inkster. Every report that I'm hearing from down there is that he's in trouble. I got a glance at some polling data down there that looks very, very bad for an incumbent state representative facing a primary. I have it on good authority that he has been added to the House Democrats incumbent protection program in one of the safest Democratic seats in the state. That's very bad.
Well, he's facing the Garden City mayor, right?
Correct.
Yeah, who has a little bit of name ID and has been the mayor down there for quite some time.
And he's the mayor of a community where more of the vote comes from than the city of Inkster, where Jewell's from. Jewell's got a fight on his hands. That's not to say he won't make it back, but he's got to get busy and he will need help.
Well, and let's remember, too, he won that seat because he was handpicked by a group of insiders.
Yeah.
After Julie Plawecki died, he was basically anointed as the heir apparent and never really had to run in a primary, right, Brian? And so, and then the general election, which is, you know, 70% Dem.
Yeah, correct, because after she passed away, they needed someone to fill the spot on the ballot, and she didn't have a primary. So a handful of people said, you're the guy, and he just kind of walked right into the, you know, to the legislature, and that's it. So, again, now he has his first real campaign, and he's running, and what is he, like 23, 24?
Yeah, he's very young, and the reports I'm getting from the district down there are that to date he has not done anything like the sort of work that you need to do to protect yourself as an incumbent if you're going to face a strong challenger, and he drew about as strong a challenger as he could have.
Let's go on to the Republican side. What do you think about Steve Johnson, Michelle Hoytinga? Both of them have some competitive primaries.
Yeah, from what I've seen, I think Hoytinga will be fine. I think Johnson might have a little bit more of a fight on his hand because I think he was someone that a bit of a crowded primary and just kind of came out of nowhere and did the work. But again, I don't know the way that district is going. I don't feel that he really fits it because, again, Kentwood, which is like a large portion, is one of those areas. It's still pretty solid Republican, but it's becoming less because, again, as we get into this sort of electoral shift where you get a lot of the suburban folks out of Grand Rapids area too. So you're seeing a little bit more moderate shift. And it looks like his opponent, Jennifer Antel, is doing a lot of work and, you know, has picked up support from Ken Yonker, former state rep, sheriff of Allegan County. So I think there is sort of a movement there just because I think, you know, they're looking for someone that I think represents a larger swath of the people because, again, going back to where these primaries matter. Again,
what about Dave Maturin versus Matt Hall?
This one's interesting. Dave's obviously got the incumbency advantage. Matt is a well-known Trump activist. Dave has done a pretty solid job in the legislature from a policy perspective in terms of moving issues that folks in the district would like to see moved. Matt was filed against Justin Amash at the beginning of this year from an address in Grand Rapids that he's still claiming a principal residence exemption for, which gives you a sort of taste of how I think that campaign's going to develop. The opposition research book on Matt Hall is thicker than my head, and I wear a 7 3/4.
So basically, Maturin can survive this challenge.
I think he can. It's a real challenge, no doubt. And I mean, Dave's done all right with fundraising and will have, you know, what would typically be the resources that you need to fight off a challenge like this. Matt's got money. You know, Matt's old man was a big wheel at General Dynamics and has given him a boatload of money. And I mean, if you've got enough of dad's money to spend, you're at least going to be able to make a dent. This will be, I expect this to be a protracted primary fight. I expect it to get exceedingly nasty. That's certainly Matt's reputation. And again, with the opposition research book that's out there on Matt, I expect there'll be a lot of punches thrown in either direction. It'll be expensive. It'll be ugly. I expect Maturin will probably ultimately prevail, but both candidates have their work cut out for you. This one's going to be real ugly.
I wanted to go back to Detroit. You kind of started in Detroit with the second district. I want to go back there because we have the mayor of Detroit, Mike Duggan, being very active in this campaign season with various candidates, Adrian. Sylvia Santana, he's supporting her. In the 4th District, he's not supporting Fred Durhall, and he's also involved in some state house races, too.
I'll be very interested to see how that turns out. Notwithstanding Mayor Duggan's political acumen on his own behalf, he's got a bad track record trying to play in elections up until now. He doesn't have a lot of victories, and it'll be very interesting to see if he can notch some this year. There are a couple of just the folks that you just listed there that probably do pull through. I expect Sylvia Santana is going to win that primary to replace Morris Hood. And that would be a good victory for Duggan, particularly because, you know, Sylvia's husband, at least, and she's expressed this publicly, although she doesn't have a track record of it, is willing to cooperate with anybody if she feels like she can be effective and get things done for her constituents. That obviously caused her husband a lot of heartburn, particularly vis-a-vis his caucus when he was here. But I think that's part of the reason that Duggan's backing her, is that whether it was his attempt at some sort of auto insurance reform or some other things, he's gotten shut down by the House Democratic Caucus a couple of times. And I think that having a couple of apostates there that are willing to work with him is pretty attractive for him.
And whether that carries over to Marshall Bullock, I guess we're going to have to see. You also would prefer Betty Cook Scott over Stephanie Chang in the first. Not sure if that's going to pan out as well for him as Sylvia Santana.
I would not bet against Stephanie Chang. In terms of a Democratic primary, There aren't many better campaigners than Stephanie Chang, just in terms of relentless effort on the doors, recruiting a really solid volunteer base, and just working the district, being at every community meeting. I mean, the woman's kind of a marvel. You know, she's married, she's got a small child, the whole bit, and manages to run a really effective constituent program as a lawmaker, and just a relentless campaigner.
Anything in the state house primaries that any district in particular that you think is particularly noteworthy?
I think the big Republican primaries to watch for are what's going to happen in the Oakland County seats, because that's where the battleground is going to be, and I think those are some of the Dems' best pickups, because you're dealing with a more moderate base, and especially in House District 40, where Trump got cleaned out in that district, you know, your Tea Party folks are not going to play well in the general electorate. So it's just a matter of finding, like, the folks that I think best sort of get through those, to those voters that appeal to the wider swath, because in that the 40th, 41st, you have pretty good field of Democrats that have can raise money, good profile, and I think that's what you got to watch for, is to make sure you get the right candidates come out of like your 39, your 40, and your 41st primaries. So you're playing in a stronger position, so you don't have to worry about any sort of Republican backlash, blue wave, anti-Trump sentiment, that you're having people that appeal to more of the sort of more moderate Republicans that aren't all like social issue types. But again, despite this being Oakland County, it's that whole primaries. It's the true believers that vote. So it's just watching that.
I don't know if it's because of a hometown kind of bias here, but God, this 69th State House District seems really competitive, Adrian.
Absolutely. I'm really enjoying watching some of the capital area primaries, the sort of environs of Lansing. You know, the 69th is super interesting. You know, you would think that Penelope would have the geographic advantage in that, because she's the candidate from East Lansing. Julie Brixey is hustling hard. She's raising money very well. She's everywhere. She's knocking doors very hard. You know, and Penelope is a very, very bright woman. She obviously owns a list consulting company that we use a great deal, that turns out quality voter data. And she does have that sort of geographic advantage of being from East Lansing. But saying that, you know, Julie has picked up some endorsements from some prominent East Lansing folks as well. That one's going to be a knockdown, drag out. I think the 68th will be less close. And, you know, full disclosure, we've done some work for Sarah Anthony. You know, Sarah's got a challenge from the chair of the MDP Progressive Caucus, Kelly Collison, that she's got to beat back. Now, Sarah is endorsed by basically every Democratic elected official in the county. She's certainly got a fundraising advantage. She's been out on doors. But, you know, Kelly will be a game challenger. You know, she certainly has a constituency with the Bernie-crats, for lack of a better term. You know, there's also the primary to replace the House Speaker, Tom Leonard, that is shaping up to be pretty interesting, where you've got Graham Filler in the AG's office, who's an ally of Tom Leonard and Bill Schuette and has been running for quite a while. The polling data that I have seen there does not look great for him. In fact, it's got him running in third right now on an uninformed ballot test. Then you have County Commissioner Ann Hill, who's performing far better than I expected. I did not expect her to be a factor in this race, even. And then you have Patrick Anderson's wife, Madhu Anderson, who's got access to personal money. She's obviously got some connections in Republican circles, both through her husband and her own work in state government.
She's already spending money, because I've gotten 3 district-wide mailers. I live in that area, so I'm getting a lot more contact on that end. You know, she has the money. Money is really helpful in primaries, because a lot of people just don't have it, because, again, people don't really want to bet on horses unless the candidate's willing to spend it. So, and I think you're seeing that. We'll see how that goes, because, again, I expect my mailbox to really start filling up in the next couple weeks with political mailers.
Yeah, and there's 2 more. You know, the primary to replace Tom Cochran, that one doesn't look to be as competitive. It looks like Kara Hope should win that one relatively easily. And then there's the primary in the 71st, which, full disclosure, we're involved in for Chuck Cascarilla. For a while, anyway, that one was supposed to be close. Senator Rick Jones has endorsed Christine Barnes, who's one of the candidates in that race. You have Chris Stewart, who's a transplant from Bath, who moved into the district to run, who's got a good family name in the wrong county. So we thought that would be a competitive race going into this, although the polling that we've seen lately is that Cascarilla is starting to pull away there. He seems like he's racking up endorsements at a little bit better clip than Christine, who seems to be the main competition. Really, she's been stuck with that Rick Jones endorsement and not much else.
And the Democrat is going to end up being?
Probably Angela Whitwer. You know, who's the CEO of a small, PR firm. She seems to be the front runner. Interestingly enough, your other front runner, Chuck Cascarilla, and her both go to church together at St. Gerard, the big Catholic parish in Delta Township where you would like to be from. And so if that matchup ends up occurring in the general election, could be a party in the church pews at St. Gerard.
And I'll have a front row seat. Go St. Gerard. Well, thanks, guys, for coming in, Jack, John. Brian Began and Adrian Heeman from Grassroots Midwest. Appreciate the time today. And that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. And thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Till next week, I'm Kyle Malone. Take care.